You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most people think of Puritans as boring, stupid, judgmental killjoys, but Sarah Vowell begs to differ. And in her latest book, The Wordy Shipmates, she claims that they actually were adventurous, uncompromising, and often even passionate people. Ms. Vowell, who is the author of Assassination Vacation, The Partly Cloudy Patriot, Take the Cannoli, and Radio On, is also a contributing editor for Public Radio's This American Life. Her book is published by Riverhead Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to the show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
Do we often confuse pilgrims and Puritans?
Yes, we do.
So we're talking about the Mayflower,
Plymouth Rock. The pilgrims are the Plymouth Mayflower folks, and I write about the Massachusetts Bay Colony Puritans who came to Massachusetts and settled Boston in the Boston area 10 years after the pilgrims.
But weren't they all from the same basic religious group?
Oh, yeah. They basically, the differences between them are pretty minimal. It's just their statement of purpose is different. The pilgrims called themselves separatists, and they wanted to have nothing to do with England and the Church of England, and they were just done with all that. Whereas my people, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they thought of what they were doing as reforming the Church of England. But really, it was all the same.
So
they just didn't want to make. They just didn't. My guys just didn't want to make the king mad. Basically.
Is this as big a rift as the Sunni and the Shia, both Muslim groups?
Well, in a way, in that the Sunni and the Shia mostly agree on just about everything. So it is one of those kind of very nitpicky little religious differences that you know, those are the ones that always cause the most explosions. It seems like, but yeah.
So if they were not unhappy, basically, with what was going on in England, why did they leave?
They were unhappy. My people are just a little more, I guess.
You're calling them your people?
Yeah. Well, I mean, compared to the pilgrims, the ones I write about. What was the question? Oh, were they basically happy? No. I mean, they thought that England was really going to hell, and they thought the Church of England was basically Catholicism in disguise, and they thought the Pope was the whore of Babylon, and, you know, they were concerned the 30 Years' War is going on in Europe, and it's Catholics and Protestants, you know, slaughtering each other, and they thought England was next, and so they wanted to go somewhere else, that being New England, and, you know, worship the way they wanted.
Couldn't they have chosen a place with a more hospitable climate?
I'm sure they probably thought that many a Massachusetts December, yes.
So did they suffer as a result of having
gone to
Massachusetts?
Actually, though, I mean, the climate kind of harsh, but, I mean, from their point of view, the bright side was that before their arrival, there had been this devastating plague that wiped out most of the native population of Massachusetts. So it was fairly open for settlement because all the Indians who had lived there were dead. So it was, in that way, to them, quite welcoming because, you know, no one was living there.
Actually, there was a plague, for one reason or another, that killed off many of the Native Americans throughout North America.
Yeah, pretty much starting in with European contact, before there was even settlement, just the explorers and, you know, travelers and fishermen brought all these germs that, you know, wreaked this horrendous plague from, you know, yeah, from one end of the Americas to the other. So
you're right that there were some Puritans who fell between the cracks. What do you mean by that?
I don't know. What part was that from?
They were, well, you did say that during the time we were talking about the struggle. And they were the people who weren't like all the other Puritans.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is like, I don't really write about the Puritans. I write about a few of them. And one, my favorite is probably, in a way, Roger Williams, who
comes across as a bit loony in your book.
He is a bit loony, but he's also incredibly righteous person in a lot of ways. He's the Puritan that the other Puritans thought was a little too religious sometimes. That, I mean, he was just obsessed with, you know, purging life in the world of everything, you know, not godly. But he also believed, you know, that the King of England didn't have the right to, you know, settle land that without natives' permission. He also believed that the government should not dictate one's religious behavior.
So even though he's very religious, he really sets in motion the tradition that's often beleaguered in this country, but still we subscribe to it, separation of church and state.
Yes, he was the one before Thomas Jefferson who calls for a wall of separation. I will say that he wants there to be a wall of separation because he doesn't want the world and the government to muddy up the church. And he's especially, you know, concerned by state-sponsored violence because he feels like when there's a state religion and that state, that government is engaged in warfare in the name of religion or not, it, you know, it bloodies up the white robes of Christ.
And he butted heads with John Winthrop, who is probably the most important figure in the story.
Yeah. I mean, the Winthrop and Williams are that relationship is kind of the heart of the book, and it is contentious. Winthrop, as governor of Massachusetts Bay, is one of the magistrates who banishes Williams to Rhode Island, or he just banishes Williams for making all this trouble in the colony. But Winthrop and Williams are friends, and so when the Massachusetts Bay Militia shows up to, you know, round up Williams to stick him on a boat back to England because he's been banished, Williams isn't there because someone has warned them that, you know, the militia's coming, and that person who warned him was John Winthrop, who, you know, took pity on him and warned him and said, if you want to stay in America, you know, you got to leave. So Williams, you know, traipses through the snow to Rhode Island and founds Providence. And then Providence and Rhode Island becomes this refuge and haven for all sorts of outcasts, not just from Massachusetts like Anne Hutchinson, but Jews and Quakers and Baptists. And it you know, eventually becomes pretty much the place in the British Empire where there's the most religious freedom anywhere.
Interestingly founded, as you say, by a man who had very rigid religious ideas.
I see Roger Williams as the ideal religious zealot. Like he is the, because he knows what a nut job he is, basically. And so he sees within religion, he just looks at it very clearly and he says, disagreement is inherent within religion. I know how strongly I hold my beliefs. I know how strongly other people hold their beliefs. Maybe we'll never agree. We should argue. We should bicker. We should debate. But we should not kill each other. There should be no violence. There should be no banishment. Everyone should have the right to live and worship at or not worship as they may. And so he recognizes his own devotion and respects that in others, even though, and because, frankly, he thinks they're all going to hell, that's enough of a punishment. Like, eternal damnation is plenty enough punishment for him. So, you know, he figures live and let live on this here earthly plane.
My guest is Sarah Vowell, whose latest book is The Wordy Shipmates, published by Riverhead Books. Well, you mentioned that John Winthrop was the governor. He was a clergyman. So how did he wind up becoming the governor?
He wasn't a clergyman, actually.
Well, he delivered one of the great sermons.
One of the great sermons. It's a lay sermon. So he is actually a farmer and a lawyer. So what was your question?
How did he become governor?
You know,
wasn't elected to
the
office.
That's just one of the kind of mysteries of history. Some of the Massachusetts Bay Company was basically a corporation. And Winthrop was this kind of like lawyer hanging around the king's court. He wasn't a member of parliament, but, you know, he was ambitious and he was smart and he was clearly, you know, devout. And the leaders of that company just saw something in him. And he, you know, took up this mantle with the kind of verve like he writes about, you know, the required tallness, you know, to be a leader. And he, I don't know why they gave it to him, but clearly they saw something in him and they were, you know, they were right because, I mean, as governor, he delivers that sermon, a model of Christian charity, you know, where we get the idea of New England and then America as a city on a hill. And, you know, I talk about holding holding his diary in my hands, going up to Boston and holding his journal. And his journal is so fascinating leading up to the voyage because it has two separate sets of lists. One is a list of Bible verses that he is considering incorporating into that great stirring sermon, you know, to inspire the voyage. And the other list, you know, in the same sets of pages is the grocery list of all the food they need, the sides of beef and the oatmeal and the peas and the butter and the cheese. And it's just this like beautiful picture of the kind of leadership where he could be both inspiring and utterly focused on the pragmatic tasks of settlement.
Let's talk about that sermon where he spoke about the city on a hill.
Let's.
For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world. He's saying that the eyes of the world are on us. Were the eyes of the world on this little group in Massachusetts?
Maybe not the eyes of the world. There were some, you know, there were a lot of, I guess, looky-loos in England looking to see if that was going to work.
Were they related at all to Cromwell's group?
Sort of. I mean, the Puritans were basically a subculture. And so, you know, the Puritans in New England and England, you know, kept up correspondence. A lot of them were in the same families. And in fact, Cromwell even briefly considered emigrating to New England if the Civil War didn't turn out.
Well, the Irish would have loved that.
They would have. The Irish, oh, they love their Cromwell. So it's a very tight-knit group, you know. It's basically like the president's father and all of his generation and how they keep showing up everywhere, you know, over the course of 40 years. It's kind of like the same group of people and they all know each other. And in fact, one of my characters I love the most is this young man named Henry Vane the Younger, who comes over as very young. He's very rich. His father works for the king, but he turned Puritan as a teenager, much to his family's dismay. And he comes over to Massachusetts, and because he's so high-born and he's so devout and rather regal, smart person and lovable, they elect this 26-year-old governor, and, you know, it all kind of goes to hell, and the Puritans, there's all this bickering and backbiting, and Henry Vane, like, bursts into tears and slinks back to England, where he actually befriends Cromwell and becomes one of Cromwell's partners in the English Civil War, and then one of Cromwell's most vicious critics when Cromwell turns dictator. So he's, like, a definite link between the two.
Now, both Presidents Kennedy and Reagan invoked the city on the hill phrase centuries later. Did the phrase mean the same thing to each of these three men?
You know, that it's interesting the part that you read, because you read the part after the city on a hill where Winthrop is imagining the idea of being a city on a hill as being, you know, something to be stared at and that people are waiting for you to fail.
But also there's a sense of exceptionalism there.
Oh, for sure.
And of course, these Puritans, they believed, because of Reverend John Cotton's proclamation, that they were God's chosen people.
Yeah.
And they had to set an example for everyone else.
Yes, but they also thought for that reason they were given this great blessing, but their responsibility was all the greater. And, you know, Cotton in that sermon quotes the Spider-Man verse from, you know, the book of Luke about responsibility coming from, you know, blessings. And so I think probably Kennedy sees it that way, because the speech Kennedy gives that I quote in the book he gives at the State House in Massachusetts a few days before his inauguration. And he's imagining Winthrop and his shipmates on the Arbella setting off on their voyage. And it is daunting. And you can tell in his speech, Kennedy is clearly, you know, he's up for this challenge ahead, but he's been thinking about Winthrop and that daunting voyage because, you know, he's about to have the you know, on-off switch to the bomb. And he's listening to Winthrop and seeking some kind of courage and, you know, to be bucked up. And
Did he know what Winthrop thought about Catholics?
You know, that was interesting the day. Like, one of the reasons I like writing these books is when I figure stuff out. Like, there are certain days I just figure stuff out. And the day I realized that the kind of poetic justice of how Winthrop and his people were able to build their anti-Catholic Protestant bastion in this place because of, you know, all the natives had been wiped out by a germ. And then in the 19th century, Winthrop's Protestant bastion is turned into the Catholic capital of America because this little germ on the potato crop in Ireland, you know, like flings all the Irish and bringing their popery with them. So that was the day I figured that out. I just like thought like there's just something so poetic about that. But as for Kennedy, you know, he was a Harvard man. That speech he gives, you know, invoking Winthrop, he also invokes Pericles, and it's this incredibly learned, you know, speech that probably a president would never be allowed to give now.
What about Ronald Reagan's version?
Oh, Ronald Reagan's version is, you'll be surprised to learn, is the more, like, look on the bright side of Winthrop. Like, to him, it's just all city on a hill, beacon of light, beacon of hope. We're better than everyone else without any of the, oh, my God, I hope we don't fail aspect.
Well, in the vice presidential debate last week, Sarah Palin touched upon the idea of American exceptionalism. Do you think that that comes out of this?
Yes, she's definitely in the Reagan school because I think right after it she says we should be unapologetic. And to, like, Winthrop, that would be fairly horrifying because his whole sermon is partly pre-apologetic. Like, let's not mess up. Let's not mess up. Let's not fail our God. Like, you know, and hers is sort of more of the everyone should look up to us. So there aspect of it's the flip side.
My guest is Sarah Vowell, whose latest book is The Wordy Shipmates. It is published by the Riverhead. Are Puritans the philosophical, spiritual, moral ancestors of our nation today?
In a lot of ways, yeah. In some ways, definitely not.
I mean, do we continue to be a Puritan nation?
I think we do in what we've been talking about, this idea of ourselves as God's chosen people who are, you know, here to help and for others to look up to. I think that for sure.
But you also tracked down a Mayflower-themed water slide in your research. So it also stays with us in another aspect of the American culture. The
yeah,
kind
literally.
Of commercialized.
Yeah, for sure. Although that, I think I say, actually, America is more like New Amsterdam, really, than New England, because it's more live and let live, let's make some money. But then one thing that we've lost that, you know, I think that I love about the Puritans is their love of language and books and learning and knowledge and you know, they really were still just like backwoodsmen, and they're starting to build Harvard, you know, because they want their sons to be learned men.
Although they sometimes took liberties when they wrote poetry, like rhyming righteousness with wilderness. Only Bob Dylan could get away with that.
That's a Roger Williamsism. Some of the writing is better than the other. But, I mean, I do love those sermons, and especially Winthrop and Cotton. And I have been thinking about them in this crisis that we're in now, you know, right now. And how scared those people must have been, and how, like, you know, words can really buck a people up. And those sermons are all about, they're not just about God and ambition. They're about, you know, being together and solidarity. And, you know, Winthrop says we should be knit together in this work as one man. And that kind of rhetoric can be really effective.
Didn't you say that you gained certain comfort from that speech after 9/11?
Yeah, the part I love in Model of Christian Charity, more than the city on a hill part, is where Winthrop is saying we must delight in each other and rejoice together, mourn together as, you know, as members of the same body.
This is actually the picture you give of the Puritans is not of the opposite of the image we have, but of a more complicated, sometimes
yes,
contradictory group. So you look at somebody like Winthrop, and here's this man who's a communitarian. He is a Christian who wants to be Christ-like, and at the same time, he also can be a tyrannical enforcer of conformity.
Yep.
These are the people who gave us, as you say, Harvard, but also at least at another time gave us the Salem witch hunts and the Scarlet Letter.
Yeah. Well, Scarlet Letter is a great book. I love Scarlet Letter.
Yeah, but that's all about people breaking the rules, especially the Ten Commandments.
They are still human beings, and that's sort of what's interesting about them. And I do kind of make parallels. To me, it's to Soviet communism, because it's sort of the same situation. Like, very idealistic, you know? Like, I mean, you know how you feel, or if you're a certain kind of person and you hear the Internationale and, you know, like, unites the human race, and there's all that, like, brotherhood, and it's so arm in arm, and then but the way that, you know, the way they enforce that solidarity is by, you know, executing or exiling everyone who doesn't agree with them. So it becomes like this totalitarian nightmare of togetherness enforced through violence, basically. That tends to happen from time to time in the history of the world.
You mentioned Anne Hutchinson,
because I mean, the book, besides, I have two. I mean, it's very American that this, I think it's the most interesting kind of philosophical question in America, that sort of the split between the individual and the public good. And so, like, I love that about Winthrop and the communitarianism, and that's an ideal that, you know, I hold dear. But there's also the romance of the individual, and the beauty of Roger Williams, even though he's a bit, you know, of a kook, is he says what he thinks, and he isn't afraid of anyone except his God, and he doesn't care if anyone likes him or respects him or wants him around. He's true to himself, and in that way, he is free. And to me, that is more romantic and more something. That's something I believe in more, you know, almost than the community, I guess, or as much. So there's this kind of tension that is just so dramatic and interesting.
I was going to.
What were you going to say?
Anne Hutchinson, because you mentioned her before.
No,
it's okay. I was very happy to hear what you just said. But I did want to get to Anne Hutchinson, who you mentioned earlier. And I wonder how this woman from Massachusetts wound up lending her name to a major parkway in the Bronx.
Oh, she was killed by Indians up there. She is, I think of Roger Williams as sort of our founding weirdo, and she's, you know, she's like the next one.
She also went to Rhode Island.
Yeah, went, was banished there. And so she is, you know, has this trial where she's banished from Massachusetts because she's just this woman who, she's like Oprah. She just draws all these people to her who want to hear what she has to say about. At first, she's just commenting on that week's sermon, but then she kind of starts giving her own sermons at her house, and all these people are showing up, and her followers are disruptive in the other churches, and so she's just, you know, she's disturbing the peace, and so they kick her out. And then they go to, she and her family, she was a really fertile woman. I think she had like 15 children. And they go to Rhode Island and build a settlement there. And then after her husband dies, she takes her children and moves to what's now the Bronx, up by the Split Rock Golf Course, actually. And there was a kind of a little war going on between New Netherland, which, you know, that was part of then, and the local Indians. And she was white, and so the Indians, I think, probably just thought of her as Dutch. And so she and all but one of her children was murdered. And So the river near her property was named the Hutchinson River, and then when they named the highway, is named after the river, so it's the Hutchinson River Parkway. And the beauty of that is that John Winthrop, who was just she was his nemesis, would be horrified that, you know, that's the main route to get from Boston to New York and vice versa. So to get to his town, you have to go on her road.
She probably would be horrified to know that all those traffic reporters say, well, there's a big tie-up on the hutch. just one more thing. How did you, somebody who I first heard on This American Life, wind up writing all these books about history?
It's actually from working in This American Life, because about 10 years or so ago, I made that documentary on the Trail of Tears, where my sister and I drove the Cherokee Trail of Tears, and that was the first story I had done about American history, and I just fell in love with it. The research, the going to the places, the trying, I felt like I could, and I, in that story, I was really proud of how we made the story coherent and kind of, I guess to use the word, entertaining. and to present the story in a way people could understand it and maybe enjoy it. And I haven't really looked back since.
Although this book does include personal stuff, but this is more like real history than and less personalized than the previous books. You're becoming a historian, Sarah.
I don't know. I'm historian-ish.
Sarah Vowell's historian-ish latest is called The Wordy Shipmates. It is published by Riverhead Books. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you, Leonard.
Sarah Vowell will be giving a Q&A and book signing tomorrow. That's Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble store at Union Square. And tonight, she's helped plan a benefit for New York City's free writing programs for children at Town Hall. That's at 8 p.m. More information about that and ways you can get tickets on our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, Political Projections is all about presidential biopics, and we'll talk about whether films like JFK and Young Mr. Lincoln are accurate depictions of history or more about myth-making. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.